Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. And if you haven't yet, be sure to smash that subscribe button. We have an amazing show for you all because boarding the mothership is Larry Houston. You know him as the director of X-Men, the animated series. He's now a consultant for X-Men 97. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars.
Hello, Mr. Houston. Thank you so much for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
It's totally my pleasure, sir. You've done so many great things. You're a part of, I think, every cartoon that matters of the last about 30 years or so, you've been a part of it. At least I think so. At least it seems that way.
I tell fans that I felt very blessed to be a part of a lot of the fun adventure shows in the 80s and 90s. I was able to be a part of all of that and actually direct some of it and make it even more fun.
Now, I mean, since you've been doing it for so long, do you find that not only have you been part of the parents' childhood, but the kids growing up now, also you're making their shows as well now. So, I mean, you're at the minimum two generations worth of entertainment.
Yeah, it seems that way. Yeah, when I got into the year, like the 2000-ish shows, I was more of a storyboard artist, as not as much as a director. So I was like a cog in the wheel in the machine. But in the 80s and 90s, I had a chance to actually be the director and make a difference for a lot of these shows. And the X-Men was like one of them that I was in charge of. And basically I made all the decisions so I could make the show into something I thought I knew on a gut level as a fanboy that it would translate and people would enjoy it.
So, I mean, where does your training come from? Like I said, your career as a storyboard artist is legendary, as in a director, legendary in the world of animation. I mean, how did you get your training for doing that? Because like I said, you've done so many things in animation, but I couldn't find where your background came from.
Well, for me, a lot of my background started, it was reading Marvel, DC comic books, mainly Marvel, at a young age. And pretty much my art was all self-taught. I would just draw my own little comic books for myself to entertain myself. And I just kind of evolved that way as far as being an artist, because I didn't go to art school. And when I was learning about cinema, a lot of the cinema I learned from watching, I didn't know it at the time, but I was watching like the TV show, The Fugitive. I was watching and taking into account how the directors directed the shows, and it just appealed to me on subconscious level, because I enjoyed it a lot. And as far as cinema, when I got into the business, there was a director called Hayao Miyazaki, and he was an anime director. His stuff was just coming into the States in about the mid early 80s, and it just blew me away. When I saw that stuff, it was mind-blowing, because it was like he was doing things in 2D that almost looked 3D, but he was using a technique that we couldn't do, and nobody had tried to do in the States. Everything was like Huckleberry Hound, Yogi Bear, flat, you know, yes. Stuff like that. Right. And he was doing some innovative shots. And so I started gobbling up all the anime stuff in the 80s as much as I could. It was this, like Area 88, Project AKO, and some others that I just kind of like glommed onto, bought the laser disc and just watched it over and over again. And that helped incorporate some new innovative styles to my storytelling. But my basis for learning how to draw basically came from Jack Kirby, John Buscema, Gene Colan, Gil Kane, comic book artists, you know.
Now, once again, I'm a comic book nerd myself, and I absolutely love comic books. The thing with comic books versus animation is that, once again, comic book is a still image, is a still two-dimensional image, versus animation, once again, obviously, is a moving image. When you're conceiving an idea, what is the mental step to go from the static comic book page to a the moving animated page?
Well, for me, I start from the beginning of like how to make a shot interesting, not just like a medium shot where the camera's like at eye level and it's kind of not dynamic. I try and I read the script, try and figure out, okay, how can I tell this in an interesting fashion? And I try and then also layer it with dramatics from like a comic book, but also because I was a director, I have to figure out, okay, how can I do this scene? And I have to do the entire choreography. That's the biggest difference between comic books and film, is that the comic book can be a snapshot of like Spidey in a certain pose.
Right.
And I have to do the entire choreography. How did he get into that pose? And how did he get him out of that pose? You know, so I have to figure out, okay, if I want to do this cool shot, I got to figure out how to get him into it and out of it. And so that's one of the challenges of being a storyboard artist, is making stuff dynamic and interesting and animatable.
Is there things that are in a static 2D shot that when you try animating it, it just doesn't work in motion?
Yes, there's some shots that won't work. You have to, like, there's a way around certain shots, but you really have to have your training grounded in choreography. Because it's not just the cool shot. It's like, how do you get there?
Right.
Okay, now how do you get them out of that? Because you can have a character in some weird, you know, hands and stuff in all these weird poses. Like, well, yeah, and what happens?
I read, I'd always do research on my guests, and I read that when you were hired by Filmation Studios, you were the first African-American Saturday morning storyboard board artist.
Yeah, so I was.
So what does that distinction mean to you? And what was the atmosphere like in those early years of you taking part in Filmation?
The fact that, when I discovered that I had been the first Black storyboard artist, I didn't know that until like 15 years, 20 years later. I didn't know that was a glass ceiling. I had a friend of mine, his name is Floyd Norman. He was actually the first Black director at Walt Disney. And we were at lunch, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, something like that. And he told me, you broke a glass ceiling. I was going, what are you talking about? And he said that, I was the first Black storyboard artist to be actually hired for that position for Saturday morning. Now, he had done his own storyboards working at Disney, but he was never hired to for that position. Because he worked on Jungle Book is where he got hired onto. I could be, is it the Jungle Book or Dalmatians? It's one of the two. Anyway, but that's where he started. And that's when he told me that night. Like, I didn't know. I was happy to get a job. I could tell you, it's like, hey, they're going to pay me to draw. That's where I was coming from. So, and at that time, they had two storyboard artists that were there. Vicky Jensen. And oh gosh, she's gonna kill me if I can't remember the other one's name. They were both really good action adventure artists, and it was like it was real nice to be part of this group, where it was like 10 of us or 12 of us, and I was, you could look at their work and it's like, man, all of them were really great artists, and they all knew what they were doing. They all got hired to work on. We were all working on, let's see, I think it's called Tarzan, let's see, Flash Gordon, Tarzan, Lone Ranger. We're all working on that show. It's like an hour of that show. And you look at their boards and are, man, everybody here is really good. And I hope I can keep up. But it was a good training ground and learning how to work within the Filmation system and storytelling. It helped you to, it was a place where you had to have a certain level of skill to get in the door, which I did. And then after that, then you as time went on, your talent just grew better and better as you did to work more and more. And so a lot of, like, Vicky Jensen, fast forwarding, because this is back in the 80s, fast forward, she was the, eventually became the director of Shrek, the first Shrek movie.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah. One of the guy who was doing prop design, he was working with Russ Heath. His name is Bruce Timm. He went on to become the director of Batman. Let's see, another one was, what's his name? Paul Smith was working there as a board artist. He went on to become a, you know, Marvel comic book artist on the X-Men and stuff. So there, and there's another guy, oh God, I'm terrible with these names, but there's a lot of talent that burst out of Filmation into the industry here and there.
So being, you know, have all this great talent together, and it sounds like there was a hell of a class to be part of in Filmation. What did you learn from watching them, and what did they take away from working with you, you think?
Oh, before I forget, her name was Lani Lloyd. So Lani, I did remember your name. Okay. Yeah, Lani and Vicky. Those are the two I remember. But I'm sorry, your question again.
Oh, no, 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 no worries, no worries. So once again, I'm looking at that incredible cast of people working together in Filmation. What did you learn from working with them, and what do you think they took away from working with you?
What I took away from them was it was a really welcoming, a lot of camaraderie, a lot of fun group that we were all together. We all had the kind of very similar sensibilities. And it was just, it was like being, I would say like being in college and stuff, having your college friends, and we're all working on the same thing. And it was a lot of fun back then from the, you know, working on the stuff. And I think what they took from me would be, you know, hey, I'm really easy to work with, and I take criticism really well, and I'm always willing to learn. And so that's what I think they got from me, is that the one thing I tried to remember as I went through my career is that once I became a director and I had the power to hire people, I tried to always remember what it's like to be on the other side of the table and always be open to new talent and to give real, if I give criticism, it's constructive. It's not destructive. It's to build you up and to help you to become what I'm doing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, as my day job as a teacher, I must say, giving criticism is a skill in all of itself, isn't it? I mean, if you don't do it quite right, it's going to be quite damaging. I mean, how did you learn to not only take criticism, but to learn to properly give it?
For me, there were artists who were there before I got there that I, like Bob Klein and Alex Toth, that had these, I would look at their boards and it was like, holy, I don't know if I can say it, but holy shit. And these things, it's like, holy shit, man, these things are so good. Oh my God, the art, the compositions, the layouts, the thought process of how I created it. I used things like the Miyazaki boards, many Miyazaki films, and people who were way better than I was at that time. I just take their boards and I would study and just try and absorb their thought process and use that to improve my own imagination, my own cinema in my head. So when I got a script, I could maybe start thinking that way and how to create a good looking show. So for me, it was like always learning, always getting better. And always, my personal thing I tried to do is always challenge myself. Like, try not to tell the story. When you get scripts where the writers write kind of like something that I've read before with other writers, okay, try and challenge myself. Okay, how can I do this and not differently? How can I do it differently? And a lot of that doing it differently came from watching anime. It was totally different from the way we did it in America. And so I when I got a chance, I would incorporate that into what I was doing.
I mean, it must have worked, like I said, to just name a few of the shows. Also, we're going to talk about X-Men at some point soon. But talk about some of the shows you've been involved in. I mean, you were in part of G.I. Joe. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And I'm gonna say my favorite show in the list, and I think it's tragically under gets less attention than it deserves, Exo Squad, which was absolutely such a terrific show.
Oh yeah.
And you're part of all of that. I mean, there's more to it. I mean, I looked at your IMDb page, and it's a long ass list of the cartoons that you worked on. I mean, I would be there all day typing the titles if I did it that way. But I picked three that, you know, that I remember watching all the time. And most of these, I will say, also have on DVD and on Amazon Prime. So I've enjoyed watching them more than once, even as an adult. So having been a storyboard artist for all these great shows, is there a common thread between all these, the success of all these shows that you'd be able to look and go, when you made The X-Men, this is how you make a good show. This is why this worked. This is why these all tend to have a common thread of success.
My approach to, like, when I was in charge of a show where I could actually shape the narrative and shape the final look of the show, like with The X-Men, I deliberately tried to follow the books as closely as I could artistically and story-wise. And my philosophy has always been, if I'm adapting a property, there's a reason why it's that property is successful. So take that property, put it on the screen. My philosophy is, I only change stuff if you have to. Don't change it because you can, you know? And so for me, it was like, take the X-Men, put it on the screen. There are things you have to adapt, which means you got to change something, but it's because you're adapting to another medium, media. I'm not sure what the word is. But anyway, because comics are like, you know, a snapshot. Whereas you got the entire, you got film, everything's moving to choreography. So, and also you have the additional problem of, like, whatever you draw for a character has got to be drawn by hundreds of other people. So, like, if you have a character that's like super dimly detailed, well, like 99% of those lines got to go. You got to break it down to the essence of what the character looks like, and that's the character that's got to go on the screen, because it's just the limitations of hand-drawn characters and series like that. I mean, now you have 3D stuff that emulates 2D, so you can put as much as you want, because it doesn't matter, the computer's going to draw it all.
Right.
But now, back then, it was all hand-drawn, so you had to work with that limitation.
Yeah, I really like that idea that you keep true to the comic book. I think that's why Marvel movies are working so well right now, is that they keep true, for the most part, of the comic books. And I feel like the X-Men cartoon did that as well. And, is it because you believed in them so much as a fan, as like growing up reading them, that you knew these concepts of these characters were and you took them seriously?
Yeah. I mean, I'm an old fanboy. I bought X-Men comic books off the spinner racks from a long time ago. And I've always, between the X-Men and the Legion of Superheroes, those are like the two group concepts that I really grew up with, that I really enjoyed. And when I was working at Marvel Productions, the other person, I had two bosses. One was Stan Lee. One was a lady named Margaret Lesh. Now, she believed in the show just like it was myself, Will Mineo, and Rick Hulbert. All three fanboys. We're all very, very deep fanboys. And she believed in it. She was an executive. And she found the money to produce Pride of the X-Men. And we were going, yes, we finally got some money to get that out there. And Will negotiated the deal with an overseas Japanese studio. Was like, I think it was Toy Animation. And they put their best people on the show. And Will did Act 1, Rick did Act 2, I did Act 3. We tried to put our best foot forward to make a good show. But what happened back then was that there's only three networks. Most kids don't realize it was CBS, NBC, ABC. No cable, no internet, no streaming, none of that stuff. And if you couldn't sell your concept to those three people, three entities, that's it. It was dead. And so we did it. They didn't understand, what's a mutant? Why are these people angry? What, they were expecting Super Friends, and it wasn't. And so it didn't go anywhere. Okay, now fast forward about from that one, about 86 to about 92, Margaret has left Marvel Productions. She's now the CEO of Fox Kids Network. And so she could green light projects. So when she got there, she called me up and Will and said, and the story editors, Eric and Julia Leewald, they said, hey, we're going to do the X-Men. And she said, we're doing it. Mm. And so we were all like, yay, you know, but she also greenlit like Batman. She greenlit Tiny Toons. She greenlit The Tick and, you know, almost all the Fox stuff. It was because of her. She's the secret superhero behind all of Fox Kids. She got all these shows on the air, you know, Batman 2. And it was Fox Kids was like became number one for about a decade, you know, for all the good stuff that they were doing. But yeah, I've been behind and loved the X-Men concept for too long. A long time.
I mean, the 90s was a hell of a time to be a kid. I'm telling you. And, you know, maybe it's the old man in me as well who looks at the current cartoons that are out there and going, these suck compared to what it was when I was a kid. When I was a kid, you know, like I said, you had Batman, eventually right. Superman, Justice League, X-Men. The Tick was so fantastic. There was so much great quality. I said X-Men, eventually Spider-Man came out as well. So much good quality. And it really was like this special time where you had great stories, you know, characters that were developed for a cartoon and were, I guess in many ways, X-Men, even, you know, and Batman took them seriously. They were as entertaining as an adult watching them as I think a kid had. How hard was it to walk that line that you wanted to both hit that kid audience, which, you know, say it, and there's also a bias about kids audiences as well. But making sure an adult can go, that's awesome.
I think I can't speak for Bruce Timm, but I think he falls in the same categories as I do, and Will Mignot and Rick, is that we grew up fans of comic books, and we happened to move into an industry of animation and we became directors, and so we became in charge of animated shows. But our heart and passion started in comic books. So when we were able to take control of artistically of the shows we were in charge of, we brought that heart and fun to the big screen, and it showed, you know, and that's how I think that's how when they hire directors to do some of these properties, one of the things they really need to look at is find someone who respects the source material, you know, someone who, if you're going to adapt like the Man of Bronze episode, you know, series, you need to find someone who likes it, doesn't want to just take it and, well, I'll just make it into something, I, you know, something different, which is like, no, that's not what it is.
Right.
You know? You got to do your research and find out if it's not something you like, then do the research and find out why is it fun? Why is it good? And then hire other people, writers, have them write it so that it is fun, you know?
And I hope the people who are making the DC movies are paying attention to that important lesson. Make sure the people who actually love the source material are the ones doing it.
Yeah, there's a whole staff at Warner Brothers who do the super the animated films. That if the film people would just talk, it's within the same company. The film people would just talk to the animation crew and just have, hey, let's talk about this. They could give them insights as to what makes these shows fun, you know?
When you were originally making these episodes, I mean, I'm sure the younger audience may not realize it, but once again, in the early 90s, before that, cartoons were not at all assumed to be for adults. I think the Flintstones had some primetime shows in the 60s, maybe for a little while.
Right.
But for the most part, when you look at the 80s cartoons, Transformers, He-Man, G.I. Joe, they're kid shows. I mean, they're made for kids. And there's no, I don't think anyone ever sat around going, what would the adults think about Optimus Prime at this moment? You know what I'm saying? But in the 90s, you had these things that were definitely directed and adults could enjoy it. Was there some pushback when the network looked at the show and gone and thought to themselves, this is not really a purely kid show?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when we were trying to get the X-Men off the ground, except for two people, Margaret Lesh and Sydney Iwaner, everybody thought we were doing it all wrong. All wrong. You got to remember, in 1992, a successful show for the network executives were either Scooby-Doo or Super Friends. And we weren't doing that.
Right.
Because we had those two advocates on our side and they wanted us to push the envelope, it gave us the opportunity to do stories that, instead of writing down the kids. No, you write up the kids. Mm-hmm. You write teen and above, and you can get more good stories out of that 22 minutes that we're on the air. And just an interesting point. Eric and Julia Leewald, when they got hired to work on the X-Men, they had no idea who they were. They're going, what's an X-Men? Let me get some books. They had no idea. Me, I knew too much. I mean, I knew stuff from the 60s up and forward. So, and so between the two of us, I was able to give them in part information about who this one was, that one was, who liked this, who hated that. And it what worked to our advantage is that they wanted to do good character dramas. And they wanted to write up to teenage and above. And so they were able to, with the blessings of Margaret and Sydney, they were able to get that into the shows. And my thing when we were talking about it is that I said, look, the kids, when they watch the first run, they're going to enjoy the laser beams and explosions and the jet and stuff. Mm. But as they watch it in the reruns, they'll start catching more of the adult subtext that's right there in front of them, but they didn't get it. Mm. And that's what I think, and we wrote it for teenage and above, and I think that's what helped with the, when people see it in repeats, they're going, oh my God, I didn't know that. Mm. Oh, that's, you know, they start picking up what we left there. And that was all deliberate on our part to, you know, what the approach we did to the X-Men series.
And there's so many just classic episodes, and we'll hit on that maybe a little bit later on, but like, I think one of my favorite episodes were like with the Phalanx, and you had Magneto and, you know, helping out all that. I mean, there's so many parts of that show that you look and you go, that's so smart. You know, that this complexity to this that didn't exist. Once again, in He-Man, where you're like, does everyone realize he looks the same with the same haircut? You know, like you get past that silliness and you go to X-Men, you're like, there's the real complexity here. And another thing that fans, I think, nowadays don't realize is that in 1992 and earlier, people don't know X-Men nationally. I mean, Wolverine, everyone knows Wolverine now, but most of us didn't know Wolverine in 1992. So what was the challenge in making these characters who, I mean, it's a big cast of characters. They're all kind of complex. They all have very different personalities. And introducing them to fans in this world who, once again, they were not part of that zeitgeist of X-Men the way they are now.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we were very conscious of is that we had to make the show not just for the fans. Like, if we just had the fans watching it, which might have been a million viewers, we would have been off the air. And so we had to appeal. Back in the 90s, you had to get like 10, 12, 14 million people watching it to stay on the air. I mean, ratings back then were like 10, 12, 14, 16. Now today on streaming it's like 0.5 or 0.9. Right. No, you on television, because you only have three networks and Fox became the fourth one, you had to have really, really good ratings to stay on the air. So we knew we had to appeal to a big audience. So we had to introduce these characters to the world. Now I drew the opening, the introduction. And so when you saw it, you saw we had the flying logo. So people could read it, you know, as the characters are flying. And then as I drew each character like Cyclops and Storm and Wolverine, we made sure their names were right by them. And they're kind of doing something that's like the ID power. Just so we tried to get that across early in the show before the content of the show began. And so it was very deliberate to try and, you know, get it out there so people can see it and then understand it. Mm. And like, the first episode was loosely based on like Alfred Hitchcock's Northwest, where in that, you know, in his film, the guy grabs one wrong suitcase and all hell breaks loose because he doesn't know what the hell's going on.
Right.
It's taken with Jubilee, where she is a young kid. This robot coming after, and she's going, what the hell? What's going on here? And, you know, eventually she gets knocked out. Cyclops decapitates the robot. She wakes up. She's in the mansion. She she's moving around, and she's you know, fish out of water type of story. By the time they do find her and catch her and they talk, there's a very good opportunity to have a very natural narrative where Storm talks to her, who we are, why we do this, and stuff like that. Mm. And we were slowly trying to introduce the concept to the world at that point. So it was all deliberate.
I kind of feel like when they made X-Men in 2000, they kind of borrowed that opening for that movie with Rogue. I was like, wait a second, I've seen that before. Jubilee, yeah. Rogue instead of Jubilee, but it's the same damn thing.
Yeah, and yeah, you read the director's cut, and basically he when he formulated his movies, he didn't know the X-Men. He just watched our shows.
That's awesome. Bryan Singer. I mean, one cool thing is about the X-Men, and it must be also complicated, is that it had a huge cast. Once again, you had Wolverine, Storm, Jubilee, Gambit, Rogue, Cyclops, Jean Grey, Professor Xavier. I mean, it's a pretty big group. Not only that, though, but yeah. You also had you had Beast and Morph in that very first episode. So one question I guess always been wondering about is, in that very first couple of episodes, you kind of write off Beast, and you kind of write off a little bit Morph. Maybe they do appear later on. Was it because the cast was too big? Was it for a particular reason where they kind of got rid off a little bit in the earlier episodes?
Yeah, the cast was big, and actually Beast was not part of the original premise, but we all liked the character, so we brought him into the show, and then we put him in prison for like 11 episodes.
Right.
So
poor Beast.
You visit him and then come back, and Morph was like, yeah, Morph was always opposed to Parrish in the first episode. In the original comic books, that when they rebooted the X-Men, it was originally Thunderbird, who was part of the group, and he gets killed. And we thought to ourselves, we're going to introduce the first Native American superhero. Kill him in the first episode.
Right.
Not a good idea. So I knew, because I knew the stuff back in the 60s, they asked me what other characters we use that passes away. And I remembered there was a character back in issue 46, 45, somewhere back there, that was called Changeling. And they introduced him as a character, as a doppelganger for Professor X, in order to bring X back into the book, because they killed him off earlier. So he was created in one issue to be a dead person. So we said, okay, let's take Changeling and put him in X-Men. But, you know, I kind of told him, you can't use Changeling, because that's the Teen Titans character.
Right, right.
And even though Marvel did it first, the lawyer said, no, we don't want to fight, find another name. And so that's where the name Morph came from. But we kept the look of Changeling, and he became Morph.
So you're never planning to bring him back the way it happens later in the series?
Nope. He was supposed to be dead. But guess what? When we got a pickup at the Marvel, I'm not Marvel, but the studios, TV studios, waited to the very last minute to tell us, you got to pick up for season 2. And said, we did a kid survey about, you know, in doing the pickup, which character did they like the most out of all, you know, Worms, Storm, Cyclops, you know, all of the above. Their number one pick was Morph.
For that two episodes.
One episode, and he was the number one character. So they said, you got to pick up, but you got to figure out how to bring Morph back. And we're going, oh my God. We killed him. So then, you know, had a powwow, started talking. And we said, okay, there's a villain called Mr. Sinister. He likes to play with biology and stuff like that. So let's use him as the bad guy and give Morph PTSD. And that's how we were able to bring him back, you know, a little distorted, you know.
That's crazy that, like I said, that he was that he would prove to be the most popular character.
Yeah, who knew? I mean, the voice actor was horrified, because we bring in the cast, we have all these actors, everybody's reading their part of the script, and they know they're going to be around for 13 episodes. That's a season.
Yeah.
And he gets his script, and he sees he dies like halfway into the show. And we're going, he's going, what?
But I mean, that was so freaking ballsy, because in the world of comic books, no one fucking dies. I mean, right. You watch Transformers, the original cartoon, they're shooting at each other for 3 seasons. No one gets hit. G.I. Joe is shooting at each other. No one dies. No one ever dies in cartoons, but you killed off Morph. that was a shock as a kid. I was like, whoa, wait a second. This character, you don't die in cartoons.
Right. And we never, he's dead. We never brought him back. We couldn't use the word dead. We couldn't say dead, die. We could say every other word around it.
That's so weird. We
couldn't use certain words.
That's so weird.
And we have a, oh God, I just lost her name again. It'll come back to me. Our censor person, we got so lucky because she came from a background of live action. She didn't work with children's cartoons. And so she was open to the fact of what we were trying to do, more adult themes. So negotiating with her, she went along with, okay, we're gonna kill this character off because that hadn't been done on Saturday morning.
Right.
And she said, yeah, let's, if you do it tastefully, and you know, Wolverine, we explained Wolverine has a different way of expressing grief. And so he punches Cyclops in anger because he's pissed off. He rakes his, he gave him a convertible, you know.
Right.
And but you know, we were really lucky that because she was involved, a lot of the storylines we were able to push the envelope, and she was on board for it.
Well, I mean, two of the big breakout stars, at least to me in the world of X-Men, at least the ones I thought were the coolest. So this is maybe a biased question, but I don't care. Whatever, it's fine. the two biggest ones to me were always Wolverine and Gambit.
Yes,
they were the most badass characters. Wolverine was badass. Gambit was badass. Did you always know that these characters would connect so well with an audience, especially the younger audience?
I knew Wolverine was, but Gambit was, when we put him into the show, he had only been in the books for like barely a year.
Hmm.
His personality was like not well-defined. And what was nice was that when the voice actors and the writers got it, they really molded his character into something that was very appealing. So I think the cartoon show actually made the comic book more popular because now it gave voice and life and style to the character. But I knew Wolverine would be popular. Gambit was like, oh, okay. So we just kept him, you know, he's a Cajun flirt. He's always, you know, trying to play with Rogue. He can't touch anybody.
Right.
But if she could, she'd be all over him.
They're only the cool character, they're visually interesting, but they're also, like you said, especially with Wolverine, potentially extremely dangerous individual. I mean, Wolverine, those claws, to show them correctly in a cartoon, you'd be killing people all the time.
Yeah.
It'd be like a massacre. You have Gambit potentially blowing stuff up with his cards.
Yes.
How difficult was it to utilize these characters, make them look awesome, but you had to completely sanitize the actual effect of the character, of the weapon?
Yeah, no, with Wolverine, it was a definite must to have robots because we had to have them cut loose. And it's, you know, it's Saturday morning, so 9 to 12 year olds. And so we had to, there are things you just couldn't do, but having the robots, Wolverine could just draw them cutting loose, you know.
Hmm.
But with real people, like he gets into fights with Sabretooth, and I had to make sure the choreography didn't have him, you know, going, you know, right to the gut or something, or through the chin or whatever. I had to make sure that didn't work. And there was a lot of creative wrestling shots and stuff and near misses and stuff. And it was challenging.
Well, I will say that Wolverine Sabretooth episode is one of my absolute favorite episodes in any cartoon. Once again, it's a much smaller episode than X-Men normally had. Mm-hmm. But you got to see a great characterization of Wolverine that usually was ignored even in the comic books, you know, the softer side of him, the more contemplative side of him. And Sabretooth, once again, in the comic books too, they don't always show how badass Sabretooth could be. That cartoon made him look freaking, you know, you think to yourself, there's no way Wolverine can beat a guy like that the way you set him up. Great episode. I mean, those are some badass characters.
Yeah, we took Sabretooth and just, we took him up. It's like, no. Bigger.
Right.
It's like, okay, this guy's a giant size Wolverine. And little Wolverine, doesn't care. He doesn't back off.
Right.
It doesn't care how big you are. You know. I mean, and that's the trait of Wolverine, you know.
And so, like I said, and I think like my Gambit, once again, here's a character who, once again, morally questionable at times. And the one thing I did look at about them as well is that, and I think everyone does like these characters, the ones that tell the leader to go fuck themselves. I think we all like those characters. And Gambit and Wolverine were the ones who always, you know, the rogue, you know, the rogue characters who told Cyclops, you know, go screw yourself, stuff like that. And you always had a potential fight in a lot of these episodes where they're going to punch out each other. But normally you kind of backed out of it. Was there a reason why you couldn't have the characters like really go at each other?
I think they took us in. If there was a reason, we would push it, but we didn't, you know, we would push the boundaries, but if there was a reason for them to go off, we wrote it in. We didn't back off on it. I mean, there's an episode, I think, where Wolverine is trying to be in charge and Gambit's getting pissed off at him. So he makes one of the bricks, he turns it on and he's getting ready to attack Gambit, and Rogue drops a built something in between them, and she goes after Wolverine. You want to try it with me? You know, that kind of stuff. You know, and then an alarm comes on, I think it was something like that, and so it distracts you from the moment. But no, we would not back off in those situations if the story called for it.
And you know, another aspect of the X-Men that was really ahead of its time, the cartoon, is that when you really stop and think about it, the female characters were actually the strongest. Rogue is physically stronger than them all. Storm, in many ways, by herself could take out most of them.
Yeah.
You made the female character stronger than the male, which was, again, ahead of its time. Was that a conscious decision or just what the characters were capable of?
That's what the characters were capable of. And part of it, it's kind of a little bit of both, because we didn't want, you know, we didn't want to show that, we wanted to make sure the women were just as formidable as the men, so that they weren't anybody needing to be rescued. It's like, no, if you take on Rogue, you take on Storm, you better be able to handle it,
because
they're going to take you out, you know. Even Jean, you know, a lot of people complain about Jean Grey, but Jean Grey, if you used her power fully, she could take everybody out too. So with Jean, we kind of like cranked it back so that there was some limitations to her powers, because otherwise there's, the episode will be over. So, you know, with Storm, we could take her down with her claustrophobia. And with Rogue, if someone touched her and she didn't expect it, that would take her out of the story. So luckily the characters had their built-in weaknesses that we could exploit during the course of the story. Jubilee had her powers, but she didn't know the extent how powerful she could be. She was the one in training. So that led for a lot of good dramatic stories where sometimes her powers would elevate in a situation. Some of it was like, it didn't do much, but she was the one in training.
And, another aspect of the show that once again was fantastic, but I will say as a fan, a little frustrating, you always brought in characters that were awesome. Like Colossus shows up, Nightcrawler shows up, a few of the other Archangel shows up. And they never stay with the team. Is there like they always had to leave? And I thought as a fan, I was like, yes, they're gonna bring in Colossus as part of the team. I was like, oh no, why did you leave? I mean, can you go a little bit over that? Like I said, as a fan, I both thought it was awesome to see Nightcrawler, but at the same time, I thought to myself, keep him on the team. I want him on the team.
The writers, this is the problem that we had. We were wishing if the studios to give us, instead of 13 episodes like each season, if they could say, okay, guess what, you got two seasons, you're going to have 26 episodes, that would have been great, because then we could have done what you just said. We could have incorporated them into the group and maybe show how it didn't work. Well, how it did work, we'd have the option to do it over 26 episodes, but because we only had 13 episodes, we had story arcs that we wanted to start and finish. And so it didn't always include the new characters, because we were trying to get through these arcs that we were doing. And the writers have always said, we only had 24 minutes to do it. And so having such a big cast just was cumbersome. And then you never got the character you wanted to portray in that episode, never got would have never gotten the full treatment if it had been so many characters in the show.
So the show lasted, I believe, 4 seasons. Is that correct?
5
seasons.
So 92 to 97. Wait. Yeah, 92 to 97.
Okay. 5 seasons. Was it a decision from you guys to shut it down? Was it the studio decided to finally cancel it? Because, and I will say this, I mean, it lasted longer than most kids cartoons had to only go, I think, 3 seasons. I had 5. So what happened to that finally it was time to close it? Was it you guys who made the decision, or was it the studio that made the decision?
It was the studio, but the thing was, I was the director for the first 4 seasons. I didn't do the 5th one. I got hired by Marvel. They hired me away to do the 2nd season of the Fantastic Four. And my assistant director took over the 5th season from me. And I went over to Fantastic Four to do that 2nd season over there. And so when I left, my assistant director didn't have the clout that I had, I think. And so they changed stuff on them and made it not the same, you know. The production company behind the X-Men was a company called Saban Entertainment. Now, Saban was the force behind the Power Rangers. So he was getting a ton of money because he owned all the merchandise for the Power Rangers. He was making hand over foot with that franchise. He was getting nothing from the X-Men because all of that went to Marvel. So the only money he could make was from the licensing fee of producing the show. Mm. But if I could send the show to a cheaper studio, we could make more money. Mm. So things changed after I left.
Yeah. So I think what got fans of the X-Men so excited right now is, I'm sure you hear enough about it, X-Men 97, which, like, yep. I said, so many fans, including myself, are like, oh shit. You know, like, we're so excited by the possibility of this thing. Because, like I said, the cartoon was so amazing. And it did feel like the comic books jumping to life. I will say I love the Batman animated series. I absolutely loved it. But it didn't look like the comic books. X-Men looked exactly like it came right out of the comic book page. I mean, we absolutely loved it.
Deliberately did that. I would take, if it was a certain storyline, I would take certain panels and put them into the show. But a fan would recognize that shot or this shot. Like, that's, you know, I did that on purpose.
Mm. And like I said, it was fantastic. What can you tell our listeners about what is going to be coming with X-Men 97?
Oh, you hit me right in my NDA.
Yeah, sorry about that.
All I can say is they got several of the original voice actors working on the show. The costuming I've seen, they're picking up, the costume is the same for the characters. And they're picking up on the stories from where we left off and going forward. But I can't talk about it. I'm sorry. I know everybody wants to hear about it, but it's right.
I'm going to ask you a few questions about it anyway. Let me, if you can't answer it, just tell me to pass. I do respect all NDAs. But let me see if you can answer this. Because once again, we're talking about animation that is 25 years later. Will it still look like the original series?
The look that I've seen was very close to what I had done. But, you know, but now they have Disney money. I had no money. They got Disney money. So I'm pretty, it's going to look a lot better than what I drew. I mean, you got to remember, back in 1992, we were on a shoestring budget in comparison. Like, Batman had twice the budget we had back in 1992. And so I had to try and make the X-Men look a lot more than what we could afford. Mm-hmm. So I used all of my production tricks and my knowledge to make the show look like a comic book, but within the budgets I had. There's a character called Mr. Sinister. And he's got a rooster. You know, instead of having a cape like Superman, he's got this cape with all these, you know, like a rooster tail come out the back, right?
Yeah.
And he's got all of these lines on himself, and it's got the dark shot. It's like, to make this character move, it would kill the animation budget that I had overseas. And so whenever I chose to treat him like Dracula. And so when you saw him, he would come, maybe come out of black, maybe this high. And then when he's talking to you, when you cut back to him, he's over there. And when you cut back, he's over on that side. Yeah, I never let him walk. And then he'd end the scene like with a maniacal laugh,
yeah,
and just go back into black. So I deliberately didn't let him walk. And in a lot of the episodes, except for maybe two episodes in the beginning, I never let the X-Men walk. They never, let's go, people, when you see this. No, I cut it all out. It's like, if someone said, let's go, it would be like on a shot like this. Next thing you see is the exhaust, the Blackbird. You know, I cut out unnecessary animation in order to help the production budget overseas, and also to keep the pace going, keep it exciting.
So in X-Men,
it's just stuff I learned over the years.
So in X-Men 97, what is your role in this series?
Eric Lee Wall, Julia, and myself have all been hired as consultants.
Okay.
And so we give our advice. We don't have the keys to the car. I gotta let everybody know that. And so that's, you know, they're in charge. They're gonna do what they're gonna do, but we try to give them our opinion when they want to hear it. and just, you know, that's our relationship right now.
So once again, if you can't answer this question, feel free to just say pass. But okay, so once again, the cartoon is being created 25 years after it ended. The audience for X-Men 97 are now, and understandably, adults. I mean, we're now, the people who watch it at 92, 97 are now the people who are now in their 40s, or maybe older or younger. I'm in my 40s, so whatever. It's my 40s. So I guess I'm the fan I'm talking about. When the new series is being produced, X-Men 97, is it being produced with the idea that the audience is now older, or is being produced at the same basic content level of the 92 to 97 series?
Well, the writers on the series are in your age, Grant. You know, they're in their 30s and 40s, so they're adapting storylines, but with the sensibilities of your generation. So, and all the people that I've talked to who are working on the show, they're all fans. They're all fans of the original series. So a lot of goodwill there.
But from a point of view, let's say like a rating, is it going to be produced as in the G-rated cartoon that it was, or is it now going to be rated as for an adult-ish more audience?
Well, it's going to be a Disney Plus, so that should tell you everything.
That's more cryptic than you think, I think.
It's what Disney Plus will allow to get on their station. So
as you mentioned a little earlier, the original series was famous for guest appearances of other famous X-Men characters, other characters as well. Can fans expect similar things to occur in the new series?
I think so. But I can't guarantee because I'm not in control.
Gotcha.
But on the original series, all the cameos were done by me. And I did it without permission. I just put them into the show. There was one episode in season one where I tried to add a cameo of Spider-Man. And they rejected it. And they wouldn't tell me why. So the next time I saw an opportunity for cameos, I didn't ask permission. I said, okay, I'm going to put it in. I'm just going to go for it. And I just knew on a gut level, because when I'm working on these shows, I try and put my adult cynicism over here. And inside, it's like, okay, what would make my 9-year-old self excited about doing this? And if I can get him, this would be cool if he does this or this, then I think I'm on track to doing a good show. And so I knew that would be, the fans would enjoy it, but I couldn't convince anybody until I just did it. And I figured, okay, if they see the show and the cameos are there, if they fire me, it's fine. But at least I got the first season done. I got it out there. My internal rule was that I would only add cameos if it didn't interfere with the original story. Hmm. So if someone who didn't know Marvel saw like Deadpool over here or some other character, it would be like, they would just be like a fire hydrant or a telephone pole. It wouldn't mean anything to them because of where I put it. But a fan would go, oh my God, that's, you know, or, oh, did you see that? You know, that kind of stuff. I knew that type of enthusiasm would be
infectious.
That's the word I should have found. And that it would create an anticipation for the next episode. Like what character they're going to see next. And so when I was a kid in the 60s, this is how old I am. I remember reading a Spider-Man, and in one panel, Thor went through. And, you know, Spidey said, hey, watch where you're throwing that hammer. You know, some kind of joke like that. And at the bottom would be, Stan wrote, if you want to see where Thor's going, pick up issue, Journey to Mystery, blah, blah, blah. So it would be, Stan was basically trying to cross promote the books for sales, but he created this connected universe by accident, which I like, wow. I remember that as a kid. So when I did the show, I wanted to put that in there. What I remembered as a 9-year-old kid reading the books and put that into the X-Men show. So that's what I did.
I mean, like I said, I really do love the original X-Men. And X-Men 90s, like I said, I'm really kind of giddy about this show coming out because, like I said, I really want to watch it. Is there a time frame that we can expect this to happen that you're allowed to talk about? Are we talking months, year?
The middle to end of next year.
Okay. So it's still a little bit of a wait.
Yeah.
I'll try to be patient. You might get a couple of texts, tweets every once in a while going, where's my X-Men 90s?
Yeah.
But yeah, no, but like I said, I think that was incredible. You know, well, one thing I did want to just quickly touch on, going back a little bit, because I do love the show Exo Squad a little bit.
Yeah.
When you're storyboarding with Exo Squad, did you realize at the time how different of a show that was? Because it felt like for its time period, it was even more adult and mature than a lot of cartoons that were already becoming more mature with that in that time period.
I did the supervising producer of X-Men was a fellow named Will Mineo, which is a friend of mine from way back. We were like the three caballeros in animation, all being friends and working on different shows. So after the first season of X-Men, he left to be in charge of Exo Squad. So he was the main guy behind that show. And we had all talked about a lot of the anime shows that were like very adult. And he knew that's one of the things he wanted to produce and do a show on. And so they gave him that freedom in Exo Squad to do that type of really adult drama. And so that was his show that he really wanted to produce and create that type of series. You know, it's so for him, it was like X-Men was my baby. Exo Squad became his, and he turned it into exactly what he wanted to, you know, a drama that he really wanted to get made.
Do you think the show premiered too early in history? Do you think if it come out 5 years ago, 4 years ago, instead of in the 90s, it would have been a bigger thing?
Yeah, but yeah, it's kind of weird. You know, it's like I feel like I'm in WandaVision timeline stuff. It's like, yeah, maybe.
It was so intelligent, but at the same time, I'm not exactly, I mean, my memory, because going back in the 90s is sketchy just because I was younger and I don't remember, but my memory is that the show would come on at like 6:30 a.m, things of that nature.
Yeah.
And that's an age group that's like 10 years old, you know, they don't think they understood the complexity of a show that really was being written way smarter than that group would understand it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that was unfortunate part of the way the show was presented to the public, you know, being a show like that, being shown at all those the inappropriate time slots. That's kind of a show that could almost be a you know, 8 o'clock show.
Yeah.
You know, something for a more mature, more older audience. And so, and it would have clicked a lot better if it had been seen at that time period. there's a show I grew up that was prime time as a kid. I remember it was Johnny Quest. It would come on either at 7 o'clock or 8 o'clock at night. And I was just fascinated. You know, I wanted to be in Johnny Quest because these two kids are all these adventures. They never went to school. And they had jet packs that were flying down, you know, going down mountains on like shield and stuff and facing monsters. And I was like, I want to be that kid, you know. But it was on at an appropriate time, and it grabbed the right audience. Mm. And Exo Squad, I think, had, if it had been given like a time slot like that for that kind of audience, it would have. Yeah, it could have even been bigger than what it is.
I think so. I mean, do you? Let's get. We're going back, obviously, a lot of years. It ended, if I remember correctly, the second season ends on a cliffhanger of what was coming for the third season that never occurred. Do you remember where it was going to go? Because I think it ended with the two factions kind of had a truce, and then there was like a third alien was about to come in the very last episode, and you're like, oh my God, what's that threat? And then the series just never goes further than that.
Boy, I'd have to talk to Will or the writers like Lynn Yulee and stuff to ask them. Unfortunately, I have no knowledge of where they're going to go next.
But, no worries.
I'd have to ask them about that. I don't know.
But like I said, those shows always one of those shows that like I have it on DVD and whatnot that I always go back to and think there was so much potential there as well. And like I said, as I was going through your IMDb, I was like, once again, just another one of those shows that I was looking at going, crap, he's part of that as well. So now what I'm going to do, I think now the game I'm going to play is, if I like that TV show, were you a part of it? I'm guessing it probably answers yes.
when I was a part of a show, I just tried whatever section of the story I got. I tried to make that as best I could. I tried to always make whatever show I was a part of, trying to do my best effort always. And like I said, the shows I enjoyed the most were the ones that I could be in charge of and then make sure all of the acts and story was the best that I could do at the time.
Well, like I said, Mr. Houston, I just want to thank you for giving me so many good years of entertainment. Thank you very much, sir. You're a pleasure to talk with as well.
Oh, thank you very much. I love the fans appreciating what I did back then, because a lot of times, a lot of us working on these shows, we were working in the dark. We had no idea if anybody liked the shows, if anybody appreciated it. And, you know, we just never, you know, we knew it had ratings, but we didn't know if anybody liked it until way afterwards, you know?
Well, with social media around now, you know damn well there's a huge group of fans that owe you quite a bit and can't wait to see what's next from you.
Oh, yeah. I was talking to joining Twitter because I didn't know, but Disney talked me into it because I guess when they were starting to do the X-Men on Disney Plus, they wanted me to get on and talk to the fans. And my God, I didn't know there was so many people out there who enjoyed the show. It was like my eyes opened up because I'm 67, so I didn't know what do I need Twitter for. So between Disney and my son telling me, Dad, you got to get to know that stuff. So
well,
I'm part of it.
My recommendation: jump on the convention circuit. There's gonna be a lot of people who want your autograph. So. Yeah. Keep that in mind. There's a lot of fans who are waiting probably to meet you as well.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm doing my best. I just got a confirmation I'm going to be at San Diego Comic-Con.
Oh, wow.
They got an artist table. And I'm trying. I asked them to see if we can do an X-Men panel. So that has not been approved yet. But at least I know I'm going to be there. So I'll be at San Diego.
Well, find a way to make it to either Rhode Island or Boston. Because we want to have you around here as well on our side of the pond, Atlantic.
if you're anybody, if you want me to come to where you are, just get in contact with that convention. And then if they reach out to me as a guest, I will always go to someplace that invites me as a guest.
Well, I definitely will, sir. And like I said, thank you so much for talking with me. Great pleasure.
Pleasure to hear too, man. Thank you for inviting me.
No problem.
Okay, take care.